In the introduction of crimes and cover-ups in American politics, Don Jeffries offers up a string of revealing and profound quotes on the recording of historical events. According to Edward Gibbon, he writes, author of The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, quote, "History is indeed little more than the register of the crimes, follies, and misfortunes of mankind," end quote. Napoleon Bonaparte declared, "What is history but a fable agreed upon?" Leo Tolstoy said, "History would be a wonderful thing if only it were true." "History will be kind to me," Winston Churchill quipped, "for I intend to write it." Henry Ford called history bunk. Mark Twain said the very ink with which history is written is merely fluid prejudice. Don Jeffries is next to challenge the court historians and set the record straight on, among other things, the Founding Fathers, the Revolutionary War, Abraham Lincoln, and the Civil War. That conversation is just moments away on Coast to Coast AM. Donald Jeffries has been researching the JFK assassination since the mid-1970s, when he was a teenage volunteer for Mark Lane's Citizens Committee of Inquiry. He's a very active member of the on all of the JFK assassination forums and has been a moderator on the London Spartacus Education Forum for several years. His first published book, the acclaimed 2007 novel The Unreals, has been compared to Alice in Wonderland and The Wizard of Oz. Hidden History was his first nonfiction book, with a foreword by Roger Stone. His latest is Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963. Don Jeffries, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you?
Fine, thanks, Richard. Have me on again.
My pleasure. And I'm enjoying the book. I'm about maybe a third of the way through it. And there are all sorts of wonderful quotes in there. Of course, the classic with regards to the writing of history comes from George Orwell in 1984, who said that who controls the past controls the future, but who controls the present controls the past. And that's what we're really talking about. Who controls the present controls the past. In other words, they get to write the history. Now, you call them the court historians. Who are they?
Well, the court historians are basically the I would make them akin to the mainstream media so-called journalists today that are misreporting on current events, that are distorting the current events. The court historians take the past and they misreport and distort past events. And they're usually from the same types of Ivy League type universities. They're tenured professors, and they are usually picked by the previous generation of court historians, much as the previous generation of politicians picks the next breed, so that nothing ever changes. And it's, as I describe in the book, they have such a vested interest in these stories. For instance, I go into things like Meriwether Lewis, just as an aside. I mean, that's so long ago. You're talking about someone that died in the early 1800s, but they're still fighting to call the government, the Park Service, and so forth, is fighting to stop his body from being exhumed, which his descendants want, because it may reveal that he was murdered rather than committed suicide, as the court historians tell us he did. Same thing goes for John Wilkes Booth. Again, a lot of theories have been out there that he was not actually buried in the body at the Greenmount Cemetery in Baltimore. Is not his. His family, his descendants, and I talked to descendants of Meriwether Lewis and John Wilkes Booth in the course of writing this book, they want that done, but the government is blocking them because they don't want to have egg on their face of it. How many times they've ridiculed conspiracy theories about John Wilkes Booth, for instance, going on and living for another 30, 40 years under another name. Well, they're not going to admit their mistakes, and this is what we find over and over again. They're so vested in these official narratives, and they just will not brook any kind of dissent. And the book is full of that, where you see how they respond to, for instance, in someone like John Tolman, who was a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, and he was a court historian in good standing. He was published by the top publishers and so forth, and again, won a Pulitzer Prize. But when he published Infamy near the end of his life, which questioned the official narrative of Pearl Harbor and pretty much demonstrated clearly that Franklin Roosevelt and the United States government wanted that to happen and allowed it to happen so that we could enter World War II, he was suddenly smeared as a Nazi by his fellow court historians, and he was drummed out of the business. And he spent his last years going to conferences with the Institute for Historical Review, which is considered a revisionist group that's not allowed in polite society. So that's what happens often when you even a court historian in good standing, you question one thing and you're drummed out of the club.
Right, and they use the term conspiracy theorist as a bludgeon to stifle dissent, as you say. I remember a story when it was a former KGB general, Primakov, I believe his name was hired by the Department of Homeland Security after the fall of the Berlin Wall, of course. He came over many years later after the fall and was impressed how dissent was quashed in the United States. And he said, you know, we use the gulag. You simply discredit and ostracize people, and it seems to be more effective.
Yeah, well, I think I'm not the only one who's ever said this, but I think Lou Rockwell was the first one that said it in my presence, where he talked about during the height of the Soviet Union, you know, that you had TASS and Pravda, obvious state-run media. And the Soviet citizens knew that they were safe. When they were listening to it, they realized, okay, this is not real journalism. These are not actual investigative reporters. These are state-run operatives who are trying to transmit to the masses that everything is fine and, you know, the statistics are glowing, life is good, comrades. The difference between that and the mainstream media we see in America today is that probably most Americans still don't realize that they're listening to state-run media, and they actually think they're listening to investigative journalists. And the same thing can be said for the people that still read history. They believe these court historians. And so when someone just sits up there and pontificates about, you know, Oswald killed Kennedy, whatever, if they're a tenured enough professor, they believe them. And they have come to the imprint manure of the established court historians on them, and so they speak with such. To listen to these court historians, if you watch them on television or something, they are so the arrogance they possess. It's just astonishing to listen to them. I mean, they would dismiss me out of hand because I don't, you know, I don't come from an Ivy League university. I'm kind of like O.E. Eisenschimmel was, who was the first critic of the Lincoln assassination. He one of his books was called "A Historian Without an Armchair" or something like that. So I'm kind of a historian from the street, but I'm you know, sourcing everything I write, and when I'm dissecting these events, it's just astonishing to see how wrong the court historians get all of them. Because, but again, their history, as the Orwell quote you quoted earlier, tells us, it's very important for the past to represent what's going on in the present. So If too much is revealed about past crimes, then present crimes may be revealed as well, and future crimes can perhaps be prevented. So I think that's why it's very important for us, as Santayana said, to study history, learn from history, lest we repeat it, because otherwise we'd be doomed to repeat it. So history is very important to me. Unfortunately, though, it's in the hands of these court historians, and certainly as people that, I wrote a lot in this book about Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, who is a secular saint for America.
Yes, and I do want to get into Lincoln. I want to spend a great deal of time on Lincoln. But I wanted to say that, you know, the book, Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963, I mean, it's vast in its scope, nearly 200 years of history. But I wanted to start really at the beginning with the what you call the slandering of the founding fathers, and we are seeing, of course, that play out now with the political correctness and pull down this statue and pull down that statue, and if that political correctness set got their way, three quarters of Washington D.C. would have to be leveled, all of the monuments. But I want to find out, and you explain this so wonderfully in the book, but you know, why don't we see movies about some of the founding fathers, like George Washington, or Samuel Adams, or John Hancock, these very rich people who put it all on the line to go up against King George III. They lost their lives, they lost their fortunes, they lost their reputation. We don't see movies about them. We'll see a Broadway show about Alexander Hamilton, though.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I don't think it's any accident, as I write in the book quite a bit about Hamilton, that Hamilton is the only founding father with a good reputation now. And that's because he invented debt. He was the first one to want a central bank. He was the banker's favorite founding father. So it's natural that he gravitated and became a hip young black rapper on Broadway. I don't think there's any, you're not going to see John Hancock or Sam Adams or John Adams, certainly not Thomas Jefferson in those roles. In fact, they're denigrated. But yeah, I don't know if anyone else has pointed out, but I wrote an entry on my blog a while back about Hollywood hates the founding fathers. When I first just started noticing that, well, even as a child, I noticed it because I was always interested in the Revolutionary era. As a child, I loved reading about the history and the founding fathers, and they seemed so heroic to me. But it took me a long time to realize, wow, of all the biopics that Hollywood made, even during its most patriotic era, there was not a single movie about George Washington, especially. I mean, just imagine that. The father of our country never had a picture devoted to him. But as I pointed out there, you had a movie about Andrew Jackson's mistress and, Andrew Johnson and certainly about Disraeli and lots of the English nobility, but nothing about the founding fathers except the biography of Hamilton. Nothing about Jefferson, who I write a lot about in the book, because I think he's the most slandered of all the founding fathers, and I think he's the most brilliant. John F. Kennedy memorably said, when he was hosting a dinner for a bunch of artists and writers, I think in 1962 in the White House, where he said, "This is the greatest assemblage of talent ever assembled together in the White House in one place, with the possible exception of when Thomas Jefferson dined alone."
That's a great quote.
That's how brilliant he was. And a liberal at that time, I don't think you could have Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. They wouldn't say that because they wouldn't pay homage to Thomas Jefferson. It really is the father of American classical liberalism. So and he's one of my heroes, and I really, really take it to heart when I hear all these people want to not only tear down his statues and take away anything that's named for Jefferson, and they're doing that now with Washington,
right,
too. I think I saw some liberals recently talk about they want to anything. I mean, to take away Washington, I mean, half the country is named. I think there's a school in every district that's named after George Washington. So that's going to be quite a task. But
right.
We
had a caller the other night who was just, very, very angry at America and was talking about slavery, which of course is a tainted the history of many countries, but I made the point is, listen, the United States did not invent slavery, but they ended it, long before a lot of other countries, including countries in this hemisphere like Brazil, and as you point out in the book, slavery is alive and well in many countries. But the other thing that you point out in the book that I thought was fascinating is that you talked about Washington and some of the founding fathers. The Revolutionary War, the American establishment, the court historians, as you call them, they seem rather the citizens would forget about America's radical anti-tax revolutionary roots. Why?
Yeah, well, I think it's pretty obvious that just reading the Declaration, I quote from the Declaration of Independence, I think, in Hidden History, where I talked about how Jefferson delineated a series of tyrannical actions by King George, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but people, readers would be it's very illuminating to read the exact words when he talked about it, because it applies so much more strongly to today, because if they were opposed and outraged to the point of revolting over the actions of which was really was a tax on stamps, a tax on tea, and the idea they wanted to be independent, but it was very small potatoes compared to the tyranny that we've been under in America for decades now, and certainly especially since 9/11 with the Patriot Act, Homeland Security, and so forth, and free speech zones and things like that that the founding fathers would be mortified by. It certainly stands to reason that they want to probably keep any kind of references to the founding fathers outside of just calling them long dead white racists. That serves the purpose of social identity politics. But to actually focus on, okay, what were they upset about? And to talk about all those talks about liberty and all the quotes about liberty, and certainly Jefferson's quotes about replenishing the blood of liberty with the tree of liberty with blood every 20 years, and that any people that no longer consent to the government they have a right to abolish it or alter it. I mean, these quotes are all out there in the record, and as a kid, I learned them, took them to heart, but it took me a long time to become sophisticated enough to realize what a lie they were in the face of the actual governance that
right.
we have found ourselves under for a long time. So certainly they don't want any references out there in the public record, and they certainly don't want Hollywood making any cool pictures, you know, showing Jefferson and Washington or John Hancock, and then, you know, these were the one percenters of their time. These were people who really did risk their fortunes, and I point out in the book, and that's no myth. What happened to these guys? I mean, a lot of them died, and almost all of them lost their fortunes, and they had really did risk something which you can't imagine the one percenters of today risking a single stock option for any kind of exercise in liberty or justice.
Right. You also, I think it was Judicial Watch you mentioned. They do tremendous work, Judicial Watch, Larry Klayman and so forth. But I think it was Judicial Watch, they discovered through a FOIA request was it an internal police training manual? And it referred to the founding fathers in that manual. The founding fathers were referred to as terrorists?
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yes. And Alex Jones, back when he was doing really good work, some years ago, he mentioned that kind of stuff over and over again, and I believe he showed videos of him, of the training videos alluding to that about the founding fathers. Because, again, at the ideals that they stood for, just read their quotes, just read the Declaration of Independence, for heaven's sakes. Just read that, and it flies in the face of everything that our authorities today are telling us. And so, clearly, not a single leader today could possibly support what the founding fathers were fighting for if the people actually knew what they were fighting for. But Americans are woefully ignorant, and they just kind of have, I guess they have something in there. Okay, George Washington was this, maybe they still think of the cherry tree. I don't know exactly, but they don't know much about history. And with today's left constantly harping on they're all racist and they're just looking at them basically as slave owners again, except Hamilton, who was this cool guy who's now a rapper. But outside of him, the rest of them were just hopelessly lost and deluded racist. And I've said many times that I fully expect at any moment for history itself to be declared racist, because they've all but done that already.
Yes. Yes, and to judge the people who lived in a particular era by the values today, I mean, these people were a product of their times, and it's grossly unfair. I mean, how will we be judged in 100 years because we eat meat?
Absolutely, and that's by the standards, and we talk about the Civil War later, or certainly the Revolutionary period, but even going up to the Civil War, even up into the World War II era, even if you go up to there, the vast majority of whites would be considered virulent racist by the standards of today, because the culture, that part of the culture, has drifted so far left to where everything is seen as racist now. So all those whites are just hopelessly denigrated as racist, and that's just wrong, because when you get to the point where somebody like Thomas Jefferson, the most enlightened man of his era, who talked about profound things, who was a philosopher on top of everything else, when you're calling, you're just dismissing him as a racist.
Right. I want to get into Jefferson and how you reclaim the legacy of Thomas Jefferson, which I just think is tremendous. We'll do that when we come back. The Staple Singers taking us into the break with The Weight on Coast to Coast AM. The Earth's magnetic field is getting significantly weaker. The magnetic North Pole is shifting at an accelerating pace, and scientists readily admit that a sudden pole shift could potentially cause trillions of dollars in damage. Today, most of us take the protection provided by the Earth's magnetic field completely for granted. It's essentially a colossal force field which surrounds our planet and makes life possible. Even with such protection, a giant solar storm could still potentially hit our planet and completely fry our power grid. But as our magnetic field continues to get weaker and weaker, even much smaller solar storms will have the potential to be cataclysmic. And once the magnetic field gets weak enough, we'll be facing much bigger problems. If enough solar radiation starts reaching our planet, none of us will survive, according to this article, which you can find in the news section, where our webmaster tonight, Greg Bishop, has posted that up at coasttocoastam.com. Reclaiming Jefferson and revealing the real Ben Franklin, Don Jeffries. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963. Don Jeffries is with us, and we will take phone calls at the top of the fourth hour. Now, third hour, I should say, rather. We were talking about Thomas Jefferson earlier, and it has become very trendy to take a run at Thomas Jefferson. As you say, he's been referred to as a racist because, yes, he did own slaves. And unlike George Washington, Jefferson, you know, did not free his slaves upon his death, but we'll explain maybe why in a moment. But he's also now being called a rapist. And this has to do with a slave. Was it Sally Hemings?
Yes.
And it's... Yeah, tell us about this narrative that he fathered her children when she was only 16.
Well, the Hemings controversy began during the campaign of 1800 between Jefferson and Adams, who ironically would later become great friends, and the correspondence between them has filled lots and lots of books that are some of the more entertaining books and by the court historians. But during the campaign, it was a campaign that we could appreciate today. There was lots and lots of personal attacks, lots of mudslinging, and a guy named James Callender first started this rumor that Jefferson had been having an affair with his slave, Sally Hemings, and it was pretty much kind of a political fodder for the day, but it was largely forgotten. Now, there were descendants of Sally Hemings that continued through oral tradition for a long time to claim that Jefferson had fathered her children. But what really wasn't until Fawn Brody put out what she called a psychobiography of Jefferson in 1974, I believe it was, where she reinvigorated this old story. And ever since that time, it just kind of picked up steam with the culture drifting to the left. It's just something that apparently they wanted to believe. And I've never really understood, because if the story is true, I'm not sure why Jefferson couldn't be painted into a hip guy that was having an interracial affair. I don't know, I guess because technically she was a slave, but Sally Hemings was favored. There's no doubt about that. And she had some kind of favored status there. But I think that was kind of standard on the plantation system. But
right. I think the idea that she was only 16 when she had this child, and, you know, today, by today's standards, she would be underage, but, you know, in 17...
That's been one of and that's definitely been proven. The same DNA tests that were trumpeted in 1998, it basically showed that there was a connection, a DNA connection between A. Jefferson, apparently is... between 25 different male Jeffersons that were around and in that area at the time. Thomas Jefferson was one of them. And Sally Hemings, for one of her children. Now, she bore several children, and that child was not the one she bore at age 16. So there was no DNA connection between a Jefferson strain and the child she bore at age 16, but he continues to be called some kind of a rapist because she was technically underage at the time, although for that era, really, 16 wasn't as young as we think of it now, because women tended to give birth at a younger age and get married at a younger age. But so that's one unfair charge. And the fact that the Thomas Jefferson, the Monticello Foundation that runs his old residence, that certainly should be, you would think, they would be working to try to present him in the best historical light possible. Ever since those DNA results, they've been run basically by anti-Jefferson type people. And as I understand it, I haven't been on a tour there, but as I understand it, in recent years, the tours around Monticello now revolve a great deal around the Sally Hemings saga. And that's, I think it's unfortunate that a man of Jefferson's abilities, just a brilliant inventor, brilliant writer, philosopher, just a sage that was light years above, really a Renaissance man, that he's now being relegated to this kind of cartoonish character, a drooling racist who is raping one of his slaves. And that's what people think of now, especially younger people, because that's what they're being taught. And if they're going to Tor Monticello, apparently that's what they're being taught there by the people that run his old mansion, presumably to continue his legacy.
Isn't there an historian who's referring to Jefferson as the monster of Monticello?
Yeah, I believe that was one of the titles of a book by a court historian that was published by, I presume, a major publisher. Yeah, and it's just like, and now because of the climate we live in, and I've certainly written a lot about that, I criticize the political correctness and the culture that produces these social justice warriors that cavalierly throw out the racist label and sexist label, whatever you want. Certainly, the racist label is number one. They throw that at public figures today. They're willing to call anybody a racist for a slip of the tongue. Well, they're going after people like Thomas Jefferson now, just the greatest figures this country has ever produced, and of course, over 200 years removed from his any ability to be able to defend himself. He's certainly not here to defend himself, and I don't know that any descendants of his are defending him either. So I'm doing it to the extent I can in this book because I don't think his historical legacy has been tarnished at all. His writings still resound, and they're timeless, unlike a lot of writings from much closer time periods to our own present era. They aren't dated because he talked, the great issues of liberty and justice and opposition to tyranny and consent to the governed. These are timeless concepts.
Right. Explain the paradox, though, John Don, because he was anti-slavery, but he did own slaves. And unlike George Washington, who freed his slaves upon his death, Jefferson did not. But there's kind of an interesting explanation. So explain that paradox, first of all, because he wrote about, the evil of slavery, and yet he had slaves.
Well, it certainly is a paradox. Jefferson was a complex man, and one of his flaws, apparently, was that he really had a tremendous inability to handle money, which is kind of goes against what he was writing about in his philosophy. But apparently in his personal life, he kind of was very generous and spendthrift, and he was always in financial trouble, always. And so one of the reasons that has been offered up by the few defenders he has left is that the reason that he simply couldn't afford to free the slaves. It was because they, obviously they were very responsible for the upkeep of the mansion and so forth. And he'd written a great deal. He had a plan on how to free slavery. And I delineate the plan in the book. But he thought that they should be because he didn't for a second believe that that human beings should be enslaved. He wrote about it constantly, but he recognized the system was there, and later, as it turned out, he was certainly accurate in his forecast because after the Civil War, a lot of problems resulted from largely illiterate slaves, and it was mainly because they weren't allowed to even learn to read and write. They were suddenly thrust into society on a supposed equal footing, and that caused all kinds of problems. And Jefferson recognized that because of the way it certainly was a white supremacist society, certainly as we look back at it now, but it obviously was when you had people that were enslaved. He wanted to go gradually, and he wanted to assimilate them gradually into society, and I believe he'd come up with by a particular date, after a particular year, anyone born after that year was automatically born free. And I think his plan would have worked a lot better, would have caused a lot less controversy, and I think we wouldn't have seen the over 100 years of really, really racial animosity that we saw with Jim Crow laws and separate bathrooms and all that that just finally was resulted in the Civil Rights Movement. But I think all that could have been largely avoided, certainly if we had avoided the Civil War, which we'll talk about later as well. But I think Jefferson's plan made more sense rather than kind of just a baptism by fire, just suddenly throwing formerly enslaved people into a society and expecting them without resources, without financial resources, without educational resources, And knowing the mindset of the people that, even though very few people actually owned slaves, the mindset of the white public at large was obviously that they didn't consider them their social equals, at least at that time. So there were lots and lots of problems that were bound to happen, and only people with like Jefferson that had the foresight, I believe, saw that they would happen. So I think he certainly didn't not free his slaves out of some kind of cold callousness, and I think that's kind of the way it's represented now by the court historians. That see, he was a hypocrite. You know, he was talking about liberty and about equality, and here he kept his slaves and he didn't even free him at his death. But the subject is a lot more complicated than that, and I explain more in the book, but I suggest people try to get the other side, and they're not going to get that other side in too many other places in my book.
Do you think it's too late to reclaim Jefferson's legacy?
Well, I hope not, but I think that, you know, we're close to a cultural war. What Pat Buchanan talked about a long time ago, the cultural war, I think we see it now in full force. And obviously Donald Trump represents a lot of that as a lightning rod kind of in the middle of that. So I think that people that are on that side, that one side, that with what today's left is, are never, certainly, no. I think it's just headed in one, it's like trying to fight against the current, where everything is going one direction. And it's just logical that this is going to keep up, where all the founding fathers, as it stands now, the statues will all be torn down, the Civil War, certainly the Confederate statues and so forth. The schools and the roads and everything will eventually be all taken off, except maybe Hamilton. Like I said, I'm sure he's still cool. Maybe Benjamin Franklin. They seem to have a little more favorable opinion of him.
Right.
Well.
That's interesting, because this is Franklin kind of represents the flip side in the book, because on the one hand you're trying to reclaim Jefferson's legacy, but on the other hand you're saying it's time we took a little closer look at who Ben Franklin really was. I mean, we think of him as this, you know, great inventor and a publisher and an author and a founding father, but a bit of a seamier dark side there too, like a complete libertine, devoid of, you know, moral principles and sort of sexual mores. Let's talk a little bit about Ben Franklin.
Well, a member of the Hellfire Club. I mean, that alone. I mean, apparently these people got together and they had prostitutes dressed as nuns, and I mean, just blasphemous type of things. And Jefferson, I mean, Franklin has quotes on the record where he clearly, and a lot of the founding fathers certainly were not conventional Christians, but Franklin in particular seems to have been, especially for that era, there weren't too many sex crazed guys. I don't think around at that time. But Jefferson, I mean, Franklin certainly was. And the Hellfire Club was aptly named, and I believe it was underneath an old monastery, way underground. And it certainly, there are interesting connections there. And Franklin had obviously the Freemasonic connections as well, which I talk a lot about Freemasons in the book. And then it's very interesting that, most interesting to me of all, was I believe it was in the 1990s, early 2000s, when a bunch of skeletons were found in Ben Franklin's old London home. And really, it kind of made headlines for a couple of days, but I was unable to find many updates about it. And I find that amazing, because I just picture if there had been skeletons found at Monticello, I think it would have been quite a bit more of an uproar, because it was Thomas Jefferson there rather than Franklin. But I quote in the book the kind of typical knee-jerk responses that were made by the people at the time that these remains were discovered, and they quickly found a young surgeon who apparently lived there with Franklin to blame, and you know, basically it was kind of an innocuous explanation, but they put all the blame on this guy who was one of the many historical figures that died way before his time, kind of an unnatural death. And I found that very convenient, but nobody even for the second seemed to entertain the thought that, okay, when if you find human remains, you know, in a basement or in a secluded area of an old home, normally you might look at the people who live there, the person who owned the property. So I find it strange that no one really, certainly no court historian, seemed to point the finger at all, especially to a guy who was in something like the Hellfire Club, which was kind of considered a notorious outfit. at the time, and in retrospect, we look back on it, and it's kind of, wow, it goes kind of beyond what the some of the other Freemasons were doing. So Franklin was, and of course, you know, personally, he was a pretty strange guy as well. He was a strange, we hear about that, you know, everybody sees that we used to, and we used to be taught this kind of history when he discovered electricity, you know, with this kite experiment with the little boy that was his son, who he became estranged from permanently during the revolution, because his son remained loyal to England, and they never spoke again. And Franklin disowned him, and the boy became very bitter later in life. And Franklin didn't treat his wife terribly well either. He was a notorious ladies' man, which, you know, looking at him, it's kind of hard to believe that. But he was kind of Hugh Hefner as his day. In fact, one of the most hilarious things I found was that he used a pickup line. Oh, God, no, I've forgotten it. He used a pickup line right out of the Declaration of Independence.
And how would you like, come back and we'll pursue the pursuit of happiness or
happiness.
Something.
Yeah, I mean, just picture that, you know, that this historical figure using that fantastic line, the immortal line, as just to pick up the floozies of the day, I guess. But, it's very interesting to look at how those two founding fathers have been treated. And Benjamin Franklin, he was an early slave owner. His newspaper advertised slaves for sale, and he didn't really become an abolitionist till near the end of his life. And yet, no one really, you'll notice it's very selective in who they, I mean, most of the founding fathers are kind of smeared that way, but they make big exceptions for Hamilton and almost as much for Benjamin Franklin.
All right, when we come back, let's delve into the history of Adam Weishaupt, if we could, and talk a little bit about the Illuminati and the Anti-Mason Party, the disappearance of Captain James Morgan. Here's a chapter of history you may not be familiar with. Don Jeffries, my guest, the author of Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963, the history you didn't read in school. Now, taking us into the break, here's kind of a Sam Cooke sound-alike, Raphael Sadiq, and Love That Girl on Coast to Coast AM.